Father James Rooney, thanks for coming. How are you?
Very good. How are you, Fuad?
I'm good and I'm quite excited. But first, can you please tell me your background and what does the title Father actually mean?
Well, so I'm a Catholic priest. I'm a Byzantine Catholic priest, which was, I'm a member of an Eastern Catholic Church. That's a little different. We can talk about that later. I'm a I'm a philosophy professor at Hong Kong Baptist University, so that's my full-time job. I teach philosophy here. And I'm a member of the Dominican Order, the Order of Friars Preachers, so you can see I'm a like a monk. So I work in metaphysics is really my area of specialty, and I work in medieval philosophy, Latin and Chinese, from around the same time period, Chinese and Latin philosophy, and I've written a lot on philosophy of religion and political philosophy. So those are two areas that I'm particularly interested in. I've written three books. I have a book, Material Objects in Confucian and Aristotelian Metaphysics. I have a book, Beyond Classical Liberalism, Freedom and the Good, which is an edited book on political philosophy. And I have a forthcoming book called Not a Hope in Hell, about philosophical problems associated with hell. So it's not a book of theology. I don't really do theology. So this is it doesn't talk about the Bible. It's about philosophical problems associated with divine providence, basically. So that's what I do.
So you said in your Facebook biography, you are a lover of Chinese culture. What is it about Chinese culture that captivates you so much?
Well, as I mentioned, I work in Chinese philosophy, so I have a deep interest in lots of classical Chinese philosophy. I got into philosophy for two reasons, one of which was connected primarily with science. So that's why I do metaphysics. I'm very interested in philosophy of science questions about, like, are there electrons? You, Fawad, and I were talking about how we know there are electrons before the podcast here started, but I was interested in questions about causality and time and space and that kind of thing. And that's what led me into philosophy, into metaphysics, because I realized that physics depends on metaphysics to justify many of those assumptions about, for instance, why we know there are electrons or whether there really are electrons or that kind of thing. And then the second way I got into philosophy, which was sort of independent or connected, is because I've always been interested in classical culture. I was interested in Greek and Roman philosophy. And when I was young, we lived in Japan. And I think that probably made me aware of classical literature, classical thinking in other cultures, in Chinese and Japanese culture. And so I read some of those things, and I have always been impressed by people like Cicero or Ovid or Catullus. And the same thing with Eastern writers. So that's sort of how I got into the connection with Chinese philosophy. And in particular, I should say, Chinese philosophy immediately. I became interested and specialized in it because I've always been very sympathetic with Confucianism in particular. So I basically think Confucianism is true. So I will identify sometimes and just say I'm a Confucian. I think their ethical system is correct. I think it's a helpful complement to many things you find in, like, other systems of virtue ethics, like Aristotelian virtue ethics. So I think Confucianism is a good system. It's true, based on lots of truth. And I'm particularly interested in medieval Confucianism because that's when they really sort of developed metaphysical system building around some of these claims about the nature of reality, human nature, the nature of human nature and its relation to other things in the universe. So that's why I became interested in that. And I'm also interested in Buddhism because they were often the enemies of the Confucians. And they're an interesting philosophical school in their own right for lots of their views. I'm coming out with... I wrote a few things on Buddhism. There's Buddhism section on Buddhism in that book on material composition. There's a paper I wrote about being not a quite Buddhist theist in religious studies, which is about how Buddhists should respond to sort of arguments for the existence of God and what sort of elements in their metaphysics would seem to accommodate belief in the existence of God and what we need to modify in order to have the existence of God in a Buddhist system, because Buddhism has been consciously atheistic. That was that paper. I have a new one, though, that is more friendly to Buddhism, that is probably going to be coming out soon in the British Journal of History of Philosophy, that I'm calling Unknowing. We'll see. It should be coming out soon. But that one's going to be a little bit more friendly to Buddhism, about the nature of what about knowing emptiness? How do we know emptiness? And why is knowledge of emptiness going to be salvific or good for us or remove suffering? Because that's what the Buddhists claim. So I'm trying to associate things they say with the way Christians think of knowledge of God in this life as being valuable for us. On that, I'm being more friendly to Buddhism. Usually I'm sort of arguing against it. But this new paper is me saying nice things about Buddhism.
Yeah, I think we have to discuss this at length at our next conversation. I will write a lot of questions about those and also about metaphysics in the future. I'm going to invite you again. Okay, so for now, here's the thing. Currently, I'm attending a philosophy of religion course at Oxford. As of now, I'm in week 6 of the course. My experience so far is quite unsatisfactory on my part, because I find that I can't answer all the questions and the assignments with philosophical answers. So I'm going to give you questions about the course provided that I find so hard to answer philosophically. I at this point, I really don't know what that's supposed to mean, but please help me in answering these questions. These questions are not graded, so don't worry, I'm not cheating here. So, yeah, the first question. Suppose we could know that God has chosen to reveal himself and his will through one or more prophets. What criteria could we reasonably employ to assess the claims of people to be this prophet or one of these prophets?
Well, what do you think? Do you think
I think honesty, the first thing that we should find as one of their characteristics. But, man. But I think people could still be deceived by themselves, by their own perception. Just to say that they're honest doesn't mean that they're telling the truth. So...
Yeah, I hope the prophet is sincere, correct. But that doesn't seem like a sufficient criteria to figure out whether they're from God or not.
Yeah, what do you think? I can only say honesty. Do you have any other answer?
Well, I think a classical response to this question, whether somebody is reasonably, we could reasonably believe that they are sent by God, is whether they can do things or say things that only God could know or say or do. So those are classical criteria for how we could discern whether somebody's a prophet. So for instance, that's a criteria that's given in the Bible, for instance, is whether what they say act. So if they predict the future and it doesn't happen, then they're not, right? But if they predict the future correctly, that would be a sort of reasonable indication that they're a prophet, right? If they're successful in their predictions, because only God can know the future, right? So, okay. That's one sort of criteria, is something like knowledge of the future. Why? Because only God can know the future. The rest of us can guess, but God can know, right? So that would be one such criteria. Another one classically is miracles. So if there's something that happens that a natural cause cannot bring about, you'd have clear evidence, right? So the idea is here's an I mean a classical example would be from the Gospels, right? One example is Jesus in one of the Gospels. This guy is a paralytic. He can't move. His friends lower him through the roof, and Jesus says to him, "Your sins are forgiven." And the scribes and Pharisees, the people who are around, who are like theologians, they say, "How can you do that? Only human beings can't forgive sins. Only God can forgive sins." And he says, Jesus responds, and he says, "So you know I can do that. I say to this guy, rise and walk." And the guy gets up and walks. And the idea, obviously, is there's evidence there, right? That he is in fact able to forgive sins, which is something only God can do. You can't see the sins being forgiven, right? Because that seems like something you can't see. Like you can't see whether God sent me, right? You can't see whether I'm really talking to God or not. But you can see whether I can do things that God only can do. In this case, raise somebody, fix somebody's paralysis immediately, right? So fixing somebody's paralysis immediately is not something we can do medically, right? Not something we can do. So that's why that would be evidence that Jesus can do those things, that he can forgive sins, that he's sent by God, that he's, you know, all that stuff.
So let's suppose that there is a man in front of you right now, not online like this, but let's just suppose that. And then that man can predict the future. He's honest, of course. And then he can do miracles. So, do you think that's sufficient to believe that that man is a prophet sent by God?
I don't think it's sufficient, but it's criteria. I mean, I think
Ah.
it would be evidence. I mean, I think you know, we, as I said, I think we'd have to investigate it. I mean, but I mean, I think if they're able to do this, I think there are other kind of criteria that would also give us that would be reasonable to employ. I think, for instance, if they contradicted themselves, you know. You can tell somebody's a scam artist if they contradict themselves. But God can't contradict himself, right? That's sort of the idea. God would only tell the truth and only be able to tell the truth, and he knows everything, so he's not going to contradict himself. There are other sorts of criteria, right? So I think those things by themselves, if he's able to predict the future and he raises people from the dead, I'd say, yeah, that's pretty good evidence. That's pretty good evidence. But whether they're a prophet or not, I think it would sort of depend on a few other things. I mean, I'd have to employ other criteria. It would depend on the situation. I don't know if it would just be individually sufficient to conclude. It depends on a few other things about the message and that kind of thing.
Okay. See, I'm excited right now. You give me a lot of new insights. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm
I
getting
mean,
ahead of myself.
here's some other criteria that the Bible employs that I think some people think are question begging, but I think are pretty reasonable. So if you think that you know, if you're the sort of person who believes, for instance, in scripture, in the Bible, you know, one of the things that Moses and some of the other it's biblical criteria to discern prophets is whether it's consistent with what God has done in the past, right? Because in Israel, they have like a history of prophets, right? So it's not just like one guy, right? I actually think that would be a problem if somebody just comes along and says, "Nobody before me has ever been a prophet, and I'm going to tell you some stuff," right? I think this would be suspicious. Because we would have reason to believe, I mean, this is what I mean by the message and things would be important. Because this is part of why Christians believe there's this history of prophecy, is because we have certain beliefs about the nature of God. God wants to be in relation with us. That's why he's revealing himself. And it's important for us that he reveals himself, right? It's something about our relationship with him is important for us. You know, we need to go to heaven and relationship with God is heaven. That's why he's telling us things. But if that's true, then it would be strange if he didn't ever talk to anybody in the past, because then all those people are just shit out of luck, going to hell or something, right? Mm-hmm. So the Christian story has always been God is in relationship with people since the beginning. Since the first moment people were created, God was talking to them because he wants to be in relationship with them. So it would be strange if somebody comes along and says, nobody before me has ever talked to God, right? So that's what I mean by criteria. There would be some things that I think in this context, what I'm inferring is I'm now appealing to some things from philosophy of religion, from philosophy mm-hmm. of God, that would make mm-hmm. it, that would make it, that would be sort of criteria to discern whether this fits, you know, what I already know. Because I think I do know some things. And I think it would be impossible to recognize God, right? Unless I did know some things, right? I have to know mm-hmm. like what a miracle is, and that only God can perform miracles in order to pick out a miracle, right? So that's already appealing to philosophy of religion, right? Natural theology. Yeah. Because I'm already reasoning about what God would have to be like. You know, if somebody says, well, God's not like that. God can't raise people from the dead, right? I'd say, right? You're not a prophet, right? You're all mixed up. But I mean, the reason I don't say miracles are individually sufficient is because we have things that could look like miracles, not just scams or something. But I mean, Christians and many other religions believe, of course, there are demons or something, right? So there's other ways that something could purport to be a miracle or look like a miracle at first glance, but it would be a trick of some kind. So I think that those possibilities are true. I mean, like those are possible, right? So I think you'd have to evaluate it on a number of different levels. It wouldn't just be if somebody performs miracles, check, right? You know, that's not a good criteria by itself.
Okay. Second question. Is it just an accident that in addition to the essential properties, all theists agree on four accidental properties of God?
I'm sorry?
I find this question is kind of weird. Is it just an accident that in addition to the essential...
So I think you're looking at... I have the list of questions, and you have two questions right after each other. So I think it's referring to the question before it. Why might one think it's incoherent to suggest there is a person who's omniscient, eternal, free, good, and necessary?
Question? In this one. I'm so sorry. Yes.
That's actually five properties. So I'm not sure what other properties we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, maybe I kind of delete that one accidentally. Oh my.
But let me just say one thing. Maybe this is a little I don't think theists agree that there are accidental properties of God at all. Very few theists think God has accidental properties in the sense of really real properties that are accidental. So classical theism, that's what we call it in philosophy of religion, says that everything in God is identical to God and everything in God is essential to God. God has no really distinct properties. So the classical view is something like God's goodness is God's love. Is God's intelligence, is God's will. All these things are identical with God. There's no real difference between God's will and God's intellect, or God's will and God's goodness, or God's will and God's power. Those divisions between those things are in our minds. They're not in God. There's no real distinction. So all those things are essential to God. God can't exist without his mind or his will or his goodness, right? Those things are not necessarily true of God. But on this view, it's impossible for God to have accidental properties, right? It would be impossible for God to be like happy today and sad tomorrow. That would be an accidental property, right? Because those two states would be really distinct in God. And so the way people reason about God, reason to the existence of God, we were talking about this before the show, but there are arguments for the existence of God. those arguments generally go like this. Classical arguments for the existence of God. We're most familiar probably with cosmological arguments, but it applies to all of them in the end. They all have a fairly similar way that they sort of end up in a certain set of views about what God would have to be like. But a cosmological argument tends to go like this. For instance, I like different versions that are given by Thomas Aquinas. But basically, they're something like, if things can change or be otherwise than they are, it's because they have some power or capacity to be otherwise. But a power or a capacity to be otherwise can't be actualized unless you have something else that's already in a state that can bring it about. But that thing, is it also in a, does it also have that power? Could it have been otherwise in some respect? If it could have been otherwise in some respect, we need something else to explain why it actually is the way it is. And this chain of reasoning can't go back forever. So we have to come to something that is that could not have been otherwise in any respect, right? It's fully necessary in all respects. Okay. So that's where we get God, is we say he's the necessary being. He's a thing necessary in and through itself in all respects. But if you notice this conclusion, this is why people conclude that God has no parts or God has no accidental properties. Because if God had accidental properties that could have been otherwise, then God isn't the thing that's fully necessary, because then he could have been otherwise. And there'd need to be something prior to God to explain why he has the properties he has. So that's why people conclude in classical theism to what we call divine simplicity, that there are no accidental properties in God. There's no such thing. There's no really distinct accidental properties. So it's true, God has some kinds of accidental properties in a certain respect. So let me give you one example of those accidental properties that's obvious. God exists and the world exists. And for most classical theists, God can exist without the world. God didn't have to create the world.
Yeah.
So in this respect, because there's a world and there's God, God has a property of having created the world. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's an accidental property of God, because there are some possible worlds where God exists and he doesn't create, right? Because create that's just what it means to say God could have not created the world. Things could have been otherwise. But classical theists explain this property of God as not a real property of God. God is the same. It's the world that's different, right? So okay. The idea on this view is something like this. To say God has the property of creating the world is a little like saying, you're to the left of me, right? Or my computer is to the front of me. That is not a change in me. If I move the computer, now it's to the right of me. Now it's to the left of me. But I haven't moved at all, right?
Oh,
so that's the idea that they have regarding how God has accidental properties in this very limited way. In philosophy and metaphysics, we call these Cambridge changes. It's a sort of joke why they have the name Cambridge changes. Complicated. I have to explain to you things about Cambridge. But that's what we call them in philosophy, is changes that don't involve any change in the subject of the change, right? Because I change in regard to being in the left of the computer or the right of the computer when I move it. But nothing about me has changed. Right. Even though the two things are true of me, the changes are all in the computer. But the way we talk about it is that, you know, it's to the left of me. So that's how classical theists explain the accidental properties of God, about what God could have done, is that these properties of him being related to the universe as being creator or something are just Cambridge changes. They're not intrinsic in God.
Okay, I'm going to remind.
But otherwise, they deny he has accidental properties. Right? Okay. God couldn't really have been otherwise in himself. That's the classical view.
So, the next question: what does it mean to say that the concept of God is simple? Can this claim be held together with the claim that God has attributes? If so, how?
Yeah. Well, I just said right. It isn't the concept of God that's simple. It's God that's simple.
It's
so we're not talking about my concept of God. My concept of God is very complicated. Your concept of God is very complicated. Because, in fact, we can't understand God except by saying many different things, right? So our concept of God is not simple. But the claim is God is simple. So when I say God is loving and God is good and God is kind and God is powerful and God is a necessary being and God has no parts and all that stuff, I'm saying a lot of different things about God. So my concept of God is in certain sense quite complicated. And in fact, I've defended that there are, in fact, we have to say all these things because actually, given our language, we can't say everything that's true about God in the fundamental way, right? So there are certain things we have to say about God that are like fundamental, important things we have to say. One of them is divine simplicity itself, because that's like what we're talking about, right? How we're talking about God. We have to say these things, and it involves complexity in our concepts, but God himself can't have any complexity. So to explain that, you have to have a fairly complex concept of God, right? You have to understand that God is the sort of thing that we can describe under different kinds of terms, but God himself makes all those terms true, even though the terms don't mean the same thing, right? So to say God is love and God is good don't mean the same thing, right? What goodness is not the same as love, is not the same as power, is not the same as intellect, is not the same as being a necessary thing. But God is all those things at once. In fact, there's no difference in God between those things in God, but the meaning of our terms is really different. So it doesn't follow to say love is goodness, is intellect, is right. That would just be logical nonsense, right? I already explained, though, why we think God is simple in this way. The reason we think God is simple is because he's a necessary being. So if he's a necessary being, he can't in any respect be different than he is. That involves not having any properties. Because a property is some way something is that is different from what it is essentially. So for instance, even my essential properties. So for instance, what is it to be me? Okay, I'm a human being, you're a human being. That's what it is essentially to be me. Is to be a human being. A human being is a rational animal. That's a classical definition of what's essential to being human. Is it essential to humans to have a body? Well, of course it is, right? It's essential to humans to laugh, right? To have the capacity to laugh. That's something essential to human beings. That's an essential property. But that's some way human beings are, right? To have the capacity to laugh. But that's not a definition of human beings. So there's some way in which I'm like causing or making true something, some distinct thing, right? Being able to laugh, right? That's something true of me, but it's not identical with being a rational animal. It's like a property that necessarily follows upon being a rational animal, but it's like it's ontologically distinct. Right? Like having a surface, right? Having a surface is something essential to being a human being because we're an animal in three-dimensional space, right? But having a surface is really distinct from the capacity to laugh, right? Capacity to laugh and having a surface are really distinct things, right? They're really distinct ways of being a thing, okay? So because they're distinct ways of being a thing, they can come apart in some ways, right? Or there's at least some way in which they're just not the same thing. But in God, that can't be true. So God can't have any such distinctions. So that's why we say that, because then he wouldn't be necessary. He would have parts that depend on him. So you might think like that. There's a way in which like having a surface is something like, It's a kind of part of me. It depends on me. It depends on other features of me in order to be there. So it's not the same as other features of me, even though it follows upon. There's nothing that's a human being that doesn't have a surface, doesn't have the capacity to laugh. But God can't have those kind of parts in him, because otherwise he wouldn't be necessary through himself in the right way. So that's the basic reason why we think God is simple in this metaphysically total way, right? So okay. We say the most The way to express how deep the simplicity goes is the classical thing Aquinas famously said, is in God, what God is cannot be different from his existence, his act of existence, and his essence have to be identical. There's no difference between what God is and his act of existing. So what it is for God, what is God, or how should we think of God, is Aquinas says we should think of God as being itself subsisting. God is, okay, is sort of like existence in the complete sense. That's what it is to be God.
Okay. Okay. All right. The next question. When, if ever, is it beneficent to fail to reveal to people important truths about yourself or the world?
So I think this question is very, very general, and I don't know if we can give a generalized answer to this as like a moral rule of thumb, but I'll tell you where it's coming from. So the question is about the problem of divine hiddenness.
Hiddenness, yeah, yeah.
That's where this question probably is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So divine hiddenness is a argument against the existence of God, raised by a guy named J.L. Schellenberg. I just published an article with my response to this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the problem in short, I don't have it off the top of my head in a very formal way, but the idea of this argument goes roughly like this, that God is supposed to be all good, all loving, and omniscient, right? All these omni properties, including being omnibenevolent. And he wants to have personal relationship with each human being. Okay. Premise one, roughly. Premise two is if God wants to have relationship with every person, then there wouldn't be anybody who fails to have explicit awareness of God having this want to have relationship with them, this desire to have relationship with them, unless they have some good reason in terms of their resisting him. So the only reason that God could have for not, revealing himself, not being explicitly aware of all these people is because of resistance of each person. But there are non-resistant non-believers. That's sort of the third premise. There are people who are not aware of God in this way and his desire to have relationship with them. And it's not because they've resisted at all. So they're called non-resistant non-believers. They either don't have any views about God's existence or who God is or whether he has, they just don't have any, or they don't believe God, right? They have some either negative or non-existent, they have no explicit attitudes toward the proposition God exists. So there are non-resistant non-believers. And then he concludes, right, if there are non-existent non-believers, then there's no God, because God would have an explicit relationship with all such persons. There wouldn't be no people that could be non-resistant non-believers if there was an all-good, all-powerful, all-knowing God, right? So it's an argument against God's existence. That's the argument. So some people argue in response to this argument, one sort of response is that God might not reveal himself to everybody because it's good for us. So okay, it's because God wants some good from us, for us, that God doesn't do that, that there are non-resistant non-believers. So if it's good for relationship with us that God doesn't reveal himself in that way, then that would undermine that second premise, right, in the argument.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea of this response. So this principle, is it ever been beneficent to fail to reveal to people important truths about yourself or the world, seems to be motivating a denial of that second premise, that God might have good reasons not to reveal himself to everybody, to fail to reveal important truths about himself, because there's some good reason. Okay. I don't like that response. Okay. J.L. Schellenberg doesn't like that response. He has lots of things to say about it, because many people give a response that, like, God hides himself for good reason, because by hiding himself, we have to, like, go look for him, and that's good for our character, or something like that, right? And J.L. Schellenberg says, but God wants everybody to be in relationship with him, and that's more valuable than any of these other things, right? It looks like these other things, like searching for him, right, is part of the value of having a relationship with him, so it doesn't look like it's a good answer. So I don't want to give to reject those answers, but I don't like them. Okay. And I think that the question is it ever beneficent to fail to reveal yourself important facts about yourself? I'm not sure I can give a general answer to that. So I'm just not sure it's very meaningful. But I'll say, in my response on this question, here's what I say. I accept that God would be in a relationship with everybody that didn't resist. The part I deny is that there are non-resistant non-believers. So what I argue is that these facts about God and the fact that there are, so I qualify what it is to be resistant. So what I say is God could have a good reason not to be in relationship with us if we did resist in the past. So I say that original sin is the answer. So what I mean by that is something like this. We should either, so you can conclude to a disjunctive proposition. Either there is no God or we resisted in some way. Okay? And there are no, strictly speaking, non-resistant non-believers. And this is compatible with God's perfect love on the argument. So I give a scenario where this would be compatible. So I say that the scenario of original sin is this scenario, because the idea is something like this. God maintains the desire to have a relationship with everybody, but what has happened is something in the past happened that damaged our ability to have an intuitive relationship with God. And it was our fault that this damaged our ability to have an intuitive relationship with God. But it gave God a good reason to switch the mode of his engagement with us. So this is the claim about original sin. So the idea is, it's not true that we have the capacity now for, we don't have, God isn't intuitively present to all of us, right? But he was in the Garden of Eden. So it was true back then that was the case, but it's not true now because Adam and Eve damaged that by rejecting God. Okay, so he's got intuitively present to us, but God switched the mode of his engagement. So now God is present in other ways to us, and God can have good reasons to do that. So I give a different explanation that God can have good reasons to be present in other ways, and it would be good for us that he's present in other ways. But in this case, the people who look like they're non-resistant are not, they're not themselves resisting, but they're part of a situation in which human beings have resisted God. So it's not strictly true that there are non-resistant non-believers. It's people who are incapable in certain ways of intuitive relationship with God. So that's what God has allowed to happen. But I argue that that's compatible with God's love, because God can switch the mode of engagement. But I say there's nothing about God's love that should prevent God from allowing us to become incapable of intuitive relationship with God through our own choices, because Schellenberg says, right, we can resist. That's not contrary to God's perfect love, because that would just rule out the possibility of sin or something like that. But God can allow this because corporate resistance doesn't undermine God's ability to have relationship with each person. So that's my answer in a nutshell to this problem. Is it's our fault. We deserve it, is the title of my paper. So it's not that it's beneficent exactly to fail to reveal things to us. It's can we deserve God not revealing those things to us? And the answer is yes.
Okay. Right, so the next question is kind of similar. If you've not asked for a particular benefaction, do you have a duty to be grateful towards the benefactor?
Well, what do you think? This seems like a general moral question. What do you think?
Yeah. If I've not asked for a particular, do you have a duty I will feel grateful, but I don't think it's bound by duty. It's just come from
my... So somebody gives you $1 million and you're happy they gave you $1 million, but you don't have a duty to say thank you.
To say like I have a duty to say that, I just don't think that's necessary. Not say it's not necessary. Okay, I'm not prepared to be asked like this. Okay. But okay. I think it will be better, a lot better if I becoming grateful and say thanks a lot, or you know, say thank you and be becoming grateful. But I don't think it's necessary have to be a duty. That's basically my answer.
Well, I mean, think? This is a moral question, and I'm a good Confucian, so I think gratefulness is near godliness. So I think everybody should be grateful for everything all the time. I think that's a piety is an important virtue of being grateful for all the gifts we receive. So, yes, I think you have a duty to be grateful. Now, I mean, maybe you're worried about duty, so let me explain how I think moral obligation happens. So here's what duty means. You can't live a good human life without being grateful for things like this, without having the virtue of being grateful when people give you gifts. So that's what it means to have a moral obligation to be grateful, is you can't live a good and flourishing human life without being grateful in this situation. So I think, yeah, it's true. If you're not the sort of person that's going to be grateful in this situation, you're not going to have a good life. You're not going to have the virtue of piety or gratefulness.
Okay, I think it's good for you
to be grateful, even when people give you things you don't ask for. Now, I think probably this principle doesn't just hold in general, but I mean, I think true benefits, yes. But I mean, somebody can give you a gift, something they think is good for you, that might not actually be good for you, or you don't, you know, is not, you know, extrinsic gifts, right, are not exactly the same sort of thing that's always truly beneficial. But I generally think you have an obligation in those circumstances, even if you don't like it, right? Somebody buys you a Christmas gift that you don't want, a new pair of ugly socks that you're never going to wear. I think you do have an obligation to say thank you for the same reason. It's always good. Okay. It's always good to be polite to people. It's always good to be grateful to them. It helps you live a good life, even if you don't like it.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, I really like this answer. Yeah. Right. Okay. Next question. This is more like a fine-tuning argument, I guess. Is there any sort of natural ordering that a universe could, in principle, display that would count as evidence of a God beyond it? This is a fine-tuning argument, right? What do you think?
Well, it's not necessarily fine-tuning. It just asks about natural ordering. So there are different kinds of natural order some could think is in the universe. So, I mean, a fine-tuning argument is one kind of natural order. So somebody could think the constants of the universe, the physical constants, are so finely in tune, each of these independently, if they varied by, you know, 10 to the 15th to the 23rd power, they would not be, life would be impossible if all these different constants were not in precisely the arrangement that they are. So people make that argument. And I think, you know, that's an interesting argument. It's an inductive argument. It's a probable argument that life would not be possible. So it looks like the universe is finely tuned for life. Okay, sure. I think that's one kind of arrangement that's interesting and would seem to be persuasive in an inductive argument. But I have other kinds of order. I mean, I think one of the kinds of order I've written on an argument for the existence of God that just has to do with the fact that things act, things have powers. And if they have powers, powers are oriented toward some particular manifestation, right? If I turn on the light or turn off the light, right, it has a power to do one thing. But why is that power about that? You know, why is it a power to to make that happen rather than something else? Why are there things that are essential to other things, right? Why are powers have something essential to them? Because the manifestation is not identical to the power. So why are things set up like that, right? Why do some things do certain things, you know, essentially? Some powers bring about certain effects essentially. Why do they do that? Well, I think this is actually the kind of order that gets us going into what are classically called teleological arguments. These are arguments that things would not have that kind of ordering unless there was an orderer, unless there was some principle of order. So in this context, what we're talking about, though, is quite different from a fine-tuning argument, because we're saying something like, it's another kind of argument from contingency, this classical teleological argument, because the thought is something like, the power could have been a power for something else, but it's not a power for that other thing, but it's contingently essential to it that it's this power rather than another power. So if it's a contingently essential situation, right, this essence is contingent in some way, why wasn't it some other way, right? And then you go back to the idea that you need something that is necessary through itself. But in this context, the thing that's the thing that's interesting about those teleological arguments is, if you think about it, what you're concluding to is very clearly an intelligent being, because you're saying something like that first cause couldn't have produced these orderings in one contingent way rather than another just by chance, because otherwise it wouldn't be necessary through itself, right? Something that acts through chance has some other reason why it's acting now rather than some other way. That's what chance means, right? Is there some other explanations going on, right? Or necessity, right? Natural necessity. God couldn't have brought about anything else. This requires appeal to something like a program, a nature that is distinct from what God is doing, right? But that introduces precisely those divisions in God that we said earlier you can't have. Right? God can't be determined by some facts about himself, his nature, to do one thing rather than another. So what it shows you is God has to be a free and intelligent agent. I mean, that this is what we mean by a free and intelligent agent. God has to be the sort of thing that that acts one way, even though he could have acted some other way. So God is the sort of thing that wouldn't act necessarily one way rather than another. There's nothing about him that makes him act one way rather than another. And his action can bring about orderings of things. And it could have been some other way, but it's only God himself that determines what the orderings are. Well, those two things put together are free and intelligent. That's what we would mean by free and intelligent, is something that can perceive and put together orderings in one way rather than another, given its own self, given its own activity. There's nothing prior to it that would make it order things in this way rather than another, but it does. So that's an argument for God that concludes God has to be intelligent and free. So that's a little bit interesting about why somebody might think teleological arguments are a cool kind of argument. One last thought on that is, in my Providence class, I've also been talking about Aquinas makes a point at in the Summa Contra Gentiles. He says, we recognize there is natural orderings of what's good and bad for us, right? So good and bad are real features of things, right? Some things are good for us, some things are bad for us. And he says many people, of course, object to the existence of God because they say, why does, if there's an all good, all loving, all powerful God, why is there evil in the world, right? One of the points Aquinas makes is actually you should ask the question the other way around. If there's evil in the world, it indicates that there's a disruption of order. Because evil is a sort of disruption or lack of some order or what's due to something. So, in fact, you should conclude if there's evil in the world, then God exists.
Okay.
Interesting. Because there wouldn't be any possibility of order in order for there to be disorder.
Yeah.
Right? So evil is a kind of disorder or lack of something. That's the classical metaphysics of evil. Is we say evil is a privation. A privation is a lack of something that should be there. Mm-hmm. So if you think that there's evil in the world, Aquinas argues, you should conclude that God exists.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to keep that in mind. The next question is the creation of life as such something worth pursuing as an end in itself?
The creation of life as something worth pursuing as an end in itself. Again, this is very general, but I mean, why not?
I don't know.
What do you think?
Okay. I don't know. This is, to me, this is a very theologically charged question. I simply cannot imagine. I cannot even imagine myself answering this question. Maybe you can help me with, you know, giving a little snippet of answer.
Well, I mean, I think one good answer is why not? I don't understand why somebody would think life would not be worth pursuing as an end. I mean, here's a thing that I think. I mean, I think anything that could exist, right? I mean, could be an end for God to create something, right? Why can't God? Maybe it's helpful to say a little bit about why God acts at all. So on classical theism, God doesn't right? God doesn't have any compelling reasons to create versus not to create, because God is essential to God. God is fully necessary, but God doesn't need to do anything. So on the classical theist answer, God can't create because he's bored, or God can't create because he wants to torment us, because to torment us would be because God wants something out of it. But metaphysically speaking, it's impossible for God to get anything out of it because God already has everything. So there's no possibility of doing anything to get anything out of it. So that can't be the kind of reason God has to do anything. So if he's going to create, it's only because it's something that God could see as good or worthwhile in itself. It's something that's desirable for its own sake, because it's because it's God is creating something that resembles himself for it. Like, that's a different way of saying it's good in itself in a certain way. It's not good by itself because its goodness is derivative from God, but it's the sort of thing that's intrinsically good, or it intrinsically exists. It has a kind of existence or goodness in itself. It's not merely, that's what I would say about life, is it looks like life is good. So why not? I mean, okay. God can create things that are good. So life is good. So I think it's the sort of thing that God could create, you know? Sure.
Why not? Okay. I think I'm agreeing with that answer. Okay. Okay, next one. What is the theist's best response to the question of what reason, if any, God had to create this universe?
Well, I just gave it to you.
Yeah,
the
why
universe
not, right?
is good in itself. That's why.
Okay. I agree with that.
I mean, the universe is a good thing. That's why God had a reason to create it. God could have created some other universe or no universe at all, right? God would have had good reasons to do all those things. But the way to think about God's reasons are like this. So God doesn't have any reason independent of himself. You know, for Christians in particular, we think God's reasons are part of God in you know, the Logos, the second person of the Trinity. Jesus, right? So God's reasons are not independent of God. God's reasons to create are God. That's the reason for creating, strictly speaking. But insofar as things exist, they resemble God. So everything is patterned on God's reasons. It's patterned on God. It's a resemblance of God. So what reasons could God have to create the universe? Well, in one sense, all of God's reasons to create the universe are the same. His reasons are God. But in another respect, a way to think about it is like this. When God creates, God is creating a reason. God doesn't like have reasons sitting there that he picks from in the same way. God creates reasons in a certain way, right? Because by his decision to create, he makes the universe good. He makes it exist. And so now it's a thing that exists, and it's as it were a reason for him to create, because the thing is good in itself. So if you want to put it like this, God's reason why to create versus not to create is the universe, right? The universe in itself is good, and God choosing to create it creates the reason why it exists. It exists for its own sake.
I'm going to need to process that one. Okay, at least we still have the recording. Okay. Okay. Sorry. Oh, next question. Is the fine-tuning of our minds...
I bring this up. Let me maybe explain that maybe a little better, if maybe it's helpful. So there's a famous poet named Angelus Silesius, and he famously has this sort of poem about a rose, and it's a famous line. The rose blooms, but it knows not why. The rose blooms without a why. I think you can ask something like this: why you? What reason does God have to create you? Well, you're the reason, right? It's because God loves you for your own sake. That's why God would create you, is because you're good for your own sake. Okay. Like if you ask, why is it good for me to love my kids? And you say, because they do a lot of things for me. That'd be a stupid reason. Yeah. I mean, it'd be morally inappropriate in a certain way, because you want to say you should love a person for their own sake in this context. That's what makes people valuable, is being a person. That's what makes them uniquely valuable. So in the same way, that's what I say about God. Here's why God creates stuff, because he loves it. That's the reason. So he loves it for its own sake. So why did God create you? Because he loves you, period. End of story. Because he loves you. That's why he created you.
Okay. Okay, the next question. Is the fine-tuning of our minds to the world... is the fine-tuning of our minds to the world something that gives one reason to suppose that there's a God?
I'm not sure what this means. So the fine-tuning of our minds to the world. So this might be something like Alvin Plantinga's argument against naturalism, or C.S. Lewis's kind of argument against naturalism. Alvin Plantinga had an argument called the evolutionary argument against naturalism, which was along the lines, I forget exactly how it goes, but it goes roughly like this, that our minds were formed through various evolutionary pressures, right? How we perceive the world and all that stuff. And if we thought it was just the result of chance, it would be very surprising. It's not through chance, but it's through what promotes fitness. But it would be very surprising if what we know is true, because it responds to evolutionary pressures and not to what's true. So he sort of gives his argument against naturalism on the basis that we should conclude that if we want to believe in naturalism itself, right, if we want to believe in evolution itself, that we know the truth about those things, and that we can make valid arguments about it, right, that we can know that our minds were formed through evolution, then we should conclude that our minds were designed, right, or something like that, to know the truth. I don't really have any strong feelings about this argument. I'm not very convinced by it, but I'm not opposed to it. I have very little strong feelings, because I'm very naturalistic. My approach to things, the Thomistic approach from Thomas Aquinas, a lot of my views are very naturalistic about things. As I mentioned earlier, when it comes to ethics, for instance, I think that what does it mean for us to have, how is God related to moral goodness and the facts about morality? I think facts about morality are objective, but they're grounded in what's natural to human beings. So human nature is what grounds morality. So God didn't have to command anything. God just had to create human beings. That's how morality happens. God doesn't have to do a second thing after he creates human beings with the natures they have. Well, I kind of think the same thing about knowledge. I don't know what it means to say our minds are finely tuned. I think our minds work or they don't. And it seems to me something like this. I mean, I would sort of argue that our ability to know things, in the sense of the way we know, involves abstract concepts, abstraction. We know things universally. So I don't just have a reaction to things, right? Like a machine, or it's not just sort of neural processes. But I tend to think we can conclude that our minds are not just material from considerations like this, because I think the way we apprehend things is as universals. But universals don't exist in material things, for the same reason that, like, the universal is not in a certain way. It's not really present in the space-time world, right? Things instantiate universals in the space-time world. They have a relation to universals. But what's in my brain is not a universal, right? My brain has symbols about things, or tokens. It doesn't have types, don't exist in my brain. But what I'm doing when I'm thinking is I'm apprehending universals. I mean, I'm referring to them, right? When I talk about things, I'm talking about what's universals, right? I'm saying the USB stick is gray. Gray is a universal. Even USB stick is a kind of universal class of things, right? And it doesn't look to me like that's possible for us to have that kind of intentionality, mental reference phenomenon. That can't happen, I think, just by a purely material system. So I think I would go a different way. I don't think it has much to do with fine-tuning at all. I think it just has to do with these facts about we apprehend the world a certain way. I don't think that it... I don't think evolutionary facts are sort of here or there myself, because I don't think they would affect in some way. The evolutionary facts would not affect our ability, in my mind, to access truth and falsity, because those are things that you require a mind for, and the mind doesn't result from evolutionary pressures in this respect. So that's not a very direct answer. That's like just gesturing to lots of other things I believe in philosophy of mind. But we call it virtue epistemology. So I'm an externalist about epistemology. So I think what you need to know something is your mind just needs to be set up in the right way, that when you know something, you're actually in contact with reality. Things are properly designed. Your judgments are the result of a basic faculty operating in its proper environment, or an epistemic virtue, a disposition operating within its appropriate environment. And so I think that these facts, though, about whether my mind can be designed, whether my eye is operating within an appropriate environment, or whether the dispositions are in general don't require God to deal with, because I mean, like, whether my eyes are operating correctly is a fact about those biological organs. But as I said, I think the difference here, what is tricky, is the mind, I think, is not a biological organ. So I don't think that that's those same considerations really apply. So I'm not very hot about Alvin planting his naturalistic evolutionary argument, but I'm not opposed to it, because I think it's probably hitting on things that I believe too. But I don't know how I'd cash it out. I'd have to be more specific.
Okay, next question. We are already past 1 hour. I think I have to condense skip a lot of questions here, but. Yeah, maybe 5 more questions, still enough for the time being. Could something of substance turn on calling God a he rather than a she?
Yes, I think so. But the way I think about it has more to do with revelation. So people have debated whether we should call God a he or a she. Clearly, on one respect, it's false that God is either a he or a she. Right? Mm-hmm. God has no sex. Yeah. Why? Because he has no body. He's immaterial.
Okay.
He's perfectly simple. So that wouldn't make any sense, right? So in one respect, it can't be true that he's a he or a she. But there are some arguments from natural theology people have made, even in natural theology, that maybe it's more appropriate to think of God as a he rather than a she. For two reasons. So the first thing is, maybe it's just a feature of our language that we need to call God either a he or a she, because he's a person, right? Mm-hmm. So, if because it's true God's a person, so it would be inappropriate to call him an it.
Right? Yeah.
You want to address him personally. So the question then is there good reason? Is there any compelling reason for using he versus she? And some people have given an argument from sort of like fittingness. So it's not an argument that it's wrong to call God a she, but that it would be more fitting to call him a he for one particular reason, because usually when people thought of gods in the polytheistic world, they thought of God as she. That tends to give rise to a view where God gives birth to the world, like a woman does, gives birth to something. And the claims about how God is related to the world is God is not related to the world like that. God wouldn't give birth to the world because God is different from the world necessarily. There's an important difference between being created and uncreated. And so you shouldn't think of the world as continuous with God, right? Like a baby is continuous with the thing that gives it birth. So there would be a problem, they think, with calling God a she, because it tends to give you that image of God giving birth to the world. So that's why we might think God is like a father, because a father is a different kind of the world wouldn't be a part of God the Father, right? The world would come from him, but it wouldn't be a part of him. So that's sort of an argument from just like fittingness. It's not a super serious consideration, but it's like it would be sort of a consideration about using one way rather than another so people don't misunderstand the God-world relation. Now, there's a second set of concerns, though, that I think is more serious, which is, so I'm not strictly compelled by that set of reasons I just gave you. The second set of reasons I think is much more compelling, but depends on Christian revelation. So the difference is in Christian revelation, we think God is a Trinity. And the words we use that are revealed about who God is God is three persons that are the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And there's a reason we call them the Father and the Son. And it has a deep kind of biblical reasoning behind why they're called that and how they're related. And in this context, we then have, I think, just you can just think of it fairly straightforwardly. There might be lots of things I could say about the doctrine of the Trinity, but I mean, like, here's a definitive reason for Christians to call God he, because Jesus does. Okay.
Okay.
And so it would be important to do what Jesus does and to speak like Jesus does about God, because Jesus is God and knows what God is like. So if he thinks it's appropriate to call God he, then we should, right? If he thinks it's appropriate to call God the Father and he, then that's true. Then that's what we should say. And the same thing about Jesus, because Jesus is God incarnate, and he became a biological male when he was incarnate. So even though the divine nature is not male or female, there's also a necessary appropriateness in calling Jesus he. It would be inappropriate to call Jesus she, because he wasn't a she, he was a he. So yeah. There are rather strong revealed reasons to refer to God as a he for Christians. But I don't think that that's of course a revealed fact. That's not something about the divine nature exactly in itself. That's a claim about what we know about God through revelation, through Christian scripture and all that. But I do think there are some reasons you might think it's inappropriate to call God a she from, as I said, just natural philosophy, because you might think God doesn't carry the world in his womb, because that would be like the world is like a part of God or something. So that's not going to be true on the classical theistic picture of how God relates to the world. So people who tend to call God she tend to have pantheistic views of God, and classical theists reject that. So that would be one reason for fittingness, not to call God a she.
Okay, next question. Do you think that there's anything that an omnipotent being cannot do? Why or why not?
Cannot do is complicated. So if we just mean, so in one respect, omnipotent means can do anything. Now, the claim is something like anything. We should understand this to be implicitly qualified in a certain way. Anything that is possible to do. Now, what that means is anything that we can describe without a contradiction. Because anything that we can describe without a contradiction is something that we can say, that is some sensible scenario of things. So people often say omnipotence involves anything that is logically possible. God can do anything that is logically possible, anything that doesn't entail a contradiction. And the way to think about this then is, why do we say that? Well, the reason is something like, why can't God do things that are logically impossible? Well, C.S. Lewis, I thought, had a very clear answer to that I think is very helpful, where he said, things that are logically impossible, what we mean by logically impossible or outside the laws of logic, is just something that can't be described. It's something that is nonsense. Right, that's what it is to say a contradiction. It's just to say nonsense. You don't say anything at all. So to say God can't do things that don't exist, right? That's not really to say any. I mean, right? Or to say, can God make a round circle? Can God make a round square? I'm sorry, God can make a round circle. Obviously, God can't make a round square because the meaning of square and round contradict each other. So you're not describing anything. So if you say, can God create a round square, you're not actually describing anything. So to ask, can God do it, there's nothing you're asking, right? So that's what it is to say he can't violate the laws of logic, or he can't do things that imply a contradiction. It's not a limit on God. It's just sort of, you might say, a limit on our ability to describe things, right? Logic is about the limits of language or something like that. It's the limits of truth, right? The limits of sense.
The limits of truth,
right?
Okay.
Yeah, logic is about the limits of truth and sense. So if you say something that's a contradiction, you're just saying nonsense. You're not saying anything meaningful.
Okay. The next question is about, could God now make it the case that Napoleon won the Battle of Waterloo, but I guess God couldn't? What do you think?
Yeah, because it implies a contradiction.
Okay, so we can skip that question, yeah?
I mean, I could say one thing a little bit more, which is people worry about the past not having been. So we can get very complicated in this discussion, but let me introduce one more thing. So people have sometimes asked, could God make it good for us to commit idolatry or to deny God's existence? Could God, like, this is the sort of divine command moralities. Could God command us to, like, murder innocent people and, blaspheme his name, and this all be morally obligatory? So you might recall earlier, I gave you a principle for morality that's very naturalistic. I said, here's how God creates morality. He creates us, period. Human nature. That's how he creates morality. Morality is entirely derivative about things that are good or bad for us to do. So on my view, it's false that God could command these things. Is it a logical contradiction? Well, it's not logically contradictory that idolatry would be good for us. That's not exactly true. There's no logical contradiction exactly in that. So here's the two ways to think about it. Could God have created something? Could God have created a different kind of thing that it was good to, I don't know, do vastly different things than we do would be good for us? Well, I think, of course, God could have created us to have a different nature, and different things could have been good for us. So, for instance, mantises, right, they mate, and the female eats the male. Okay. Could that have been good for us? Well, the answer is yes, right? God could have made us just like mantises, right? Okay. And it would have been good for us, like it's good for mantises to do that. It's not good for human beings to do that. So there would be a contradiction in a certain kind of respect, though, which is given that God created human beings with this nature, then God can't command us to do things that would be contrary to our nature, because God would be contradicting himself.
Oh, yeah. That's
given the things he's already done and the intentions he already has, for him to command other things would be to contradict himself. But again, God can't do contradictions, right? The idea is contradictions would be nonsense. So we can understand in this respect, there's a kind of limit on God's omnipotence, but it's not really a limit on the omnipotence, right? It's sort of just a limit on God making sense, right? It wouldn't make sense for God to do one thing, right? To set up nature's one way and then command them to do something that's contrary to the nature. Because in this context, then it would just be God contradicting himself. Like I said, God can't, through a prophet, right? If God contradicts himself, says two things that can't be true at the same time, not X and not X, we'd know that person is not a prophet, because God can't possibly lie or contradict himself. So in the same way, God can't do things that are contradictory, like make the past not to have been, strictly speaking. God could maybe create an alternate timeline universe, like in Back to the Future. That doesn't strike me as impossible. Right? God could set things up like that, because then there wouldn't be a contradiction. The same thing with, like, God could have created us like mantises. Moral facts could have been different than they are. That's true. But given that he created human beings, given that he set the world up this way, he couldn't then command us to do things contrary to the nature, because that would be God contradicting himself. And we can understand that it would be impossible or stupid, because God's in control of what the natures are in the first place. So if he wanted us to do the one thing, he would set up the world that way. It would be strange for God to, like, correct a mistake, because God can't have mistakes.
Right. Okay. How would you describe the difference between seeing God as everlasting inside time and seeing God as eternally outside time?
Well, I'm not a big fan of this idea, or this question, I should say, because I think it strikes me as a little confused. So, but on the classical views of God, we might say, some people say God is outside of time. But this is not, I think, quite the right way to think of it. So my teacher was Dr. Eleanor Stump, and she's famous for writing a paper on eternity. And she appeals to a famous medieval philosopher, Boethius. And Boethius has a famous definition of eternity, which is the eternal, the complete and simultaneous possession of everlasting life. Okay. And the idea of this definition is not that God is in time, because in this respect, the idea is something like God is present to all time at once. God is eternally, and he's completely and fully and simultaneously present to all time. So on this view, we might say God is outside of time, but what we mean is something like, it doesn't mean God is like unconscious or something. It doesn't mean God is, has no life of any kind. It means God is exists in relation to time in a different way than we do. On this view, God creates time. He creates the universe and then is present to it. But God doesn't exist, you might say, in the four temporal dimensions we do. God has a different relation to the timeline, because God has a different relation to existing and living. So on this, I think that's the way to think about God. God is, in this respect, outside of time. I think everlasting in time, I think the idea is something like, at every time God exists, and God undergoes changes throughout time. Yeah. It's true to say God passes through time in his life. And I think this is confused. I think this is a bad view. And the reason I think it's a bad view is because of what I already gave earlier. It violates those views about divine simplicity, because God would have really accidental properties that would change over time. Being at this time rather than that time. So if God could undergo those changes, whether intrinsic changes in his consciousness or just the fact that he has a real property of being related to passing through time, right? That seems like a property. Even if something is everlasting in time, it's passing through time. I think that's what they mean when they say everlasting in time. If that's what they mean, then God would have an accidental property. And the reason that's a problem is we'd have to explain, why does God have this relationship to, right? Why, how could God be contingent? What explains why God is contingent in this way? And then what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to appeal to something else. And that something else is going to be the fully necessary being that's God, not the thing you were talking about in the first place. So it's going to lead to a contradiction in your theology of God. So that's why I don't like those views that God is temporal, is because they imply a contradiction. They entail a contradiction.
Okay. Yeah, the next question, I don't think you're going to like this one either. Do you think the theist should see God as constrained by metaphysical necessities as well as logical? They say constrained with a...
Well, of course not.
Okay.
I mean, it depends, though, what we mean by metaphysical necessities. I mean, I think that's, in one respect, that looks stupid because God creates the metaphysical necessities. I mean, God creates the things. So, you know, the world, the natures that exist are what ground what I think of as metaphysical necessities. That's one way to think of what metaphysical necessity is. So, the difficult, complicated question is what we mean by metaphysical necessity. Because as I mentioned earlier, when we talk about metaphysically true, I don't like this language because I think it's dumb. Because I think what we mean by metaphysically true is just true. There's no metaphysically true. There's true and there's false. Okay. So I think it's sort of the same with possible and necessary. Possible and necessary. There's possible and necessary. There's not really logically possible. There's not really metaphysically possible. There's possible and necessary. There's only a question of what we're talking about. So when we say logically possible, all we mean is able to be stated sensibly. That's logically possible. Is able to be stated sensibly. Metaphysically possible, I think, could only mean something like is possible. Full stop, right? Mm-hmm. Because metaphysical possibility would be the widest sense of possibility. Is able to be. That's what it would mean. But that's just possibility. Is able to be, right? So every kind of possibility falls under metaphysical possibility. Now, so I think that's one reason I don't like this. But let me say specifically what they might mean. One way of interpreting the question is, could God... So there are certain facts about God that are necessary. And I think would be because certain things are, right? It is just to say God is necessarily the way he is, right? So like, could goodness be evil or something like that? Well, that's impossible because of the nature of good. Mm-hmm. And is good contingently good? Well, no, it isn't. Good is necessarily good, or like existence. Is existence contingently existence? I don't know what that means. That seems confused because it's like saying, it seems like you're just saying some kind of nonsense. So on the classical medieval way of thinking about words like good or true or one, these sorts of things are just different ways of talking about existing, being. So could being be not being? That's a stupid question because it's just a contradiction. Being is necessarily being, right? What we mean by being, what we're referring to is like the thing, right? Being. Okay. So could the word being mean not being? Well, of course it could, but that's just a fact about language. If we're talking about is being able to be not being, that's stupid, right? That's a stupid question. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a contradiction. It's nonsense. So I think there's a sense in which there's metaphysical necessities like that. Which is God, could God not exist? No, right? So there's a metaphysical necessity that God would be constrained by. God can't make himself not exist. Okay, but like that's because it's contradictory. So this is a different way of saying when we say something is contradictory, it's just to say you're saying nonsense. So in context of metaphysical possibility, metaphysical necessity, I think it's just a way of saying, is it possible? And in this, it's just not possible because it's nonsense, right? To say like being could be not being, God could not exist. That just is a way of saying nonsense, right?
Okay. Last question. I think the last question is kind of nonsensical too, but could it just be an accident that there is or that there is not a God? If not, why not?
Well, this is then that plain God is the necessary being.
Mm.
So, I mean, right, if God is necessary being, that's what it is to be God. Well, then it can't be an accident.
An accident, yeah.
So some people give, by the way, this might be a helpful thing to know. Some people give an argument based on that fact about God. So this is sometimes called the modal ontological argument. And Basically, so a modal ontological argument is a little different from an ontological argument of the classical Anselmian type. And do you know the difference? You were not.
Yeah, the modal ontological argument is, if it's necessary, then it is necessary. Necessarily, God exists, therefore God exists. It follows the S5 modal logic.
Well, it's true. So the idea is something a little bit more complicated. So the idea is a little bit more complicated than that, which is something like this. Is it possible that God exists? If it's possible that God exists, God is necessarily existing being. So, right. The idea is if it's truly possible that God exists, then God exists necessarily. And if he exists necessarily, he exists in reality. And so it's a way of saying something like, if you admit that it's possible that God exists, the sort of thing God is a necessary being. So if God exists in one possible world, then there'd be a contradiction in saying he doesn't exist in all possible worlds.
Yeah.
So if it's really possible that God exists, then he necessarily exists now, right? Mm. In our world. But I think this is a complicated kind of version of this ontological argument. I think it suffers from the same problem in general, which is when people say, is God possible? They're not talking about, is it possible in general? They mean something like, is it possible to imagine that God exists? Or is it possible to state what God is, what God would be if he existed, right? God is a necessary being or something like that. But the sort of trickiness of these arguments is they move from those kind of claims to whether it's really possible, something like that. So people sometimes then have to establish that it's really possible. That God exists. And so if you admit it's really possible that God exists, you're tied into those arguments. I mean, you have to accept the conclusion. And there might be a way to say we can prove it's possible that God exists. I think that's not a stupid thing to think. But so that's why I think those arguments are better than the classical ontological arguments. But I would just draw attention to how they work. They're basically saying if God is really possible, I mean, you can just think of it like that, right? What is the definition of possibility in modal logic? The definition of possibility is exists in one possible world, at least one possible world. But if God exists in at least one possible world, then he exists in all possible worlds, because that's what it is to be God, is to be necessary. So it would follow if you admit he's possible, he exists in all possible worlds, right? So it would be a contradiction to say God is possible and he doesn't exist. And he possibly does not exist, right?
Yeah.
So that's the contradiction they're showing. And it's true, but the question is it really the case that God is possible in the way that they're talking about? And I think we can argue for it, but it's a different kind of argument, I think. Anyway, so it wouldn't be an accident that God exists. That's the basic dealing.
Okay, that will be all. Thank you, Father Rooney.
Well, you're welcome. Is there anything else you want to ask in general? Maybe you had lots of questions on your sheet that you sent me about me and about Catholicism. So I don't know if you have any last questions you might have about any of that I could answer before we go. Because maybe you're not exposed to some of that, or you don't know about.
Well, I want to ask you a lot about Catholicism, actually, because there is a lot of misconception about Catholics here in Indonesia. But I don't think we have enough time, and maybe to be more thematically focused, we can discuss about this in our next podcast. I really want to discuss about metaphysics and Catholicism in our next podcast. But if there is anything I want to ask you as our closing question, is were you really finished playing Black Myth Wukong?
Yeah, of course I finished the game.
Cool.
I beat the final boss.
I haven't even finished like 13% of it. How did you do that? I mean, you're busy, man, right?
Well, I did it. I beat him. I played through the whole game. I did, in fact, complete all the side missions, more or less. I beat all the optional bosses and things. I haven't finished the whole game. I beat through the main story, but I'm actually still struggling with one boss. There's a secret boss. I'm not going to tell you to ruin the story, but there's a secret boss, and he's really hard. So I've gotten very close to beating him, but I have not yet beaten him. I've been working on it the past couple days, but I haven't been putting too much time into it because I'm working on a book right now. I just went to a university, gave a talk, and then I came back, and I'm working on a book on dogmatic authority, which is related to the Protestant Catholic sort of debates. And so I've been working on that book. And so I've been sort of on and off playing the Wukong game. So I finished the main storyline, but I haven't finished beating this final boss yet. I'm not anxious about it because I already finished the game. So I'm just waiting to finish the last bit later.
Well, given the difficulty, it's still a very, very great achievement, you know.
So... I think it's one of my favorite games of all time. It's a great game. It's not as hard as Dark Souls, though. I think I haven't finished that game because I haven't dedicated any time to it. I played a little bit of it, and it's too complicated in terms of, I think the mechanics to me are just too obtruse, and I don't have enough patience because I have to work on other things. So Dark Souls, I bought it, but I haven't even finished hardly any of it because it's too I have to dedicate too much time to it. But the Wukong game I really liked. I thought it was beautiful. I thought the story was great. I've read Journey to the West and all this stuff, and so there's lots of stuff in there that's interesting to me in terms of Chinese culture and that. And I was turning on the Chinese, so I could listen to the Chinese instead of the English and practice my Chinese a little. I thought it was a great game. It's one of the first Chinese video games that really does a good job. So I was very, very proud of it, too, for the Chinese people. They did a good job, and I'm happy they can produce something like that. It's an achievement.
Cool. So how do you say goodbye in Chinese?
Well, a typical thing to say is zaijian.
Zaijian.
See you again.
Zaijian.
See you
see
later.
You again.
See you again. Zaijian.
Zaijian. Okay, so Father Rene, zaijian.
Zaijian. Very good, Fuad.